You're here with us at the lab for the Sci-Fi Happy Hour.
Sci-Fi Happy Hour, everybody.
Welcome, everybody.
To a special Saturday edition.
Oh, yeah, special.
Of the Sci-Fi Happy Hour.
This would be our Irish coffee.
That's right. Yeah, we're enjoying a little bit of Jameson Black Barrel with our coffee this morning.
On a Saturday morning.
We got some donut holes. We are ready to go. We have a special guest with us, too.
Special guest for you.
All right. So let me lay it on you. We've got Richard Phillips here. Rick Phillips. If you're going to look for him on Amazon, Richard Phillips. But he's born in Roswell, New Mexico. This guy is an incredible author. He's got multiple book series going right now. Probably the most famous book series so far is going to be The Roe Agenda. He's got a prequel series based off of that called The Roe Agenda Inception. And then as well, a series that takes place after the main three books called Roe Agenda Assimilation. He's got a bunch of other projects as well going on right now. And we definitely want to make sure that we highlight just how interesting this gentleman is and his background as an Army Ranger.
Graduated from West Point, no less.
West Point. I mean, really. He's got a master's in physics, wrote at Los Alamos National Laboratory for his research, and definitely he's living here in Phoenix with his wife, and we're really happy to have him on the show today.
Yes, welcome, Rick. Glad you're with us.
It's my pleasure, guys.
So what's going on for the weekend today? You got anything fun and exciting?
Well, actually, I'm working this weekend. I spent 10 days in Hawaii last week and a half. So I really got my fill of chilling out, and I'm ready to get back to work.
Oh, that's exciting. Okay, so since you're talking about work, is there any kind of habit or process you get up? Like maybe you wake up at 4:30, go for a 3-mile run, and then you go right to it? Or do you get right out of bed and start riding? Can you describe it?
You keep telling yourself that. That's a good vision of me. There's kind of two phases. There's three phases, really. When I'm first starting to develop a story, I spend probably 2 months just storyboarding it and figuring out, okay, what are my main characters? What are the good guys? What are the bad guys? What motivates them? I cast them so that I've got if I was going to turn it into a movie, I would want to know which actors I would pick to play each role. And that way, by doing that and taking a screenshot of that photo and putting it in a Word file where I'm describing that character, it makes them more real, more clear in my mind. When I put the plot together, I follow a standard kind of three-act architecture for the plot. And I make sure I get all the plot points I want figured out, especially where does this story start? I mean, how does it start and how does it end? And then the dominoes in between that have to fall. And once I've worked all of that stuff out in my mind and I've filled in enough dominoes, I don't do it. I'm not a detailed outline guy. They would probably call me a pantser more than a planner. So I want to stay within the framework I created, the storyboard, but a lot of times as I'm filling in details from my imagination, I'll describe, this rainy street, maybe New York City, cabs are sloshing water up onto the curb, people are trying to keep their pants from getting wet. I might just for detail add some alley off to the side and some woman come running out of it or something. And sometimes that can make me wonder, get really interested. What is down that alley and can I make it part of the story?
Now, your books are so interesting. I'm talking specifically about The Roe Agenda, filled with the alien technology and the government secrecy, and it's going around these high schoolers and their adventure and their growing up. How does one make this stuff up? Is it some kind of knowledge with the existing technology and adding the what-if scenarios, or is it taking it a step further? Is it closer to reality than imagination?
Well, it does help that I have a science background and an Army background. But that said, you're writing sci-fi, you're making crap up. So the important thing in my mind is, I like to keep in mind a saying that I think I read in a sci-fi novel growing up, which is the map is not the territory. And what that really means from a physics perspective is there is no such thing as science fact. We make models of reality, but we don't make reality. We have a model, a physics model that we believe today, which is a quantum mechanics-based model, at least on the microscopic level. But you can guarantee that what we think is science fact today, 100 years from now, we're going to be laughing about it. So when you're writing science fiction, I like to keep that in mind, and I like to question assumptions that we just assume are laws of physics now. You know, the speed of light is a constant. Well, I like to ask myself, what if that's not true? What if it just seems like it's a constant? The same for conservation of energy. You know, what if energy really is not conserved? What if some of it leaks into subspace or something like that? So as I'm making stuff up, I just want to develop a system of rules that apply in the future where I'm writing or in some different galaxy where I'm writing. It's definitely going to be different than the science today, otherwise it wouldn't be science fiction.
Yeah, exactly. True. Very true. Now, along with that vein, just kind of a sub-thought, do you ever have where you're giving your manuscript to beta readers and they're saying, well, that couldn't happen? And you're like, well, of course it couldn't happen. I'm imagining it. I'm making it up. So do you ever find yourself in that kind of combat?
Actually, beta readers are very important to me because I don't care what kind of background you have, you don't have every background.
Right.
And you're creating a world where every background exists. So sometimes you're going to write about something you probably don't know about. So I like to try to Google it or Wikipedia to get some basic knowledge. But then I'll write something and I'll have some beta reader that's a surgeon or something tell me, well, you know, that's really not physically possible for that to happen like that. An example of that was I had a scene which I in my book Dead Wrong, which is in the Inception series, where my super killer Jack Gregory is fighting this big albino guy that's essentially got him in a bear hug and is crushing the life out of him. And I had him bite the guy's throat out. Well, the problem with that, the surgeon that was one of my beta readers said, well, you know, the human mouth isn't really shaped sufficient for that, especially if you've got a real muscular neck guy, probably can't reach the carotid artery. So I was like, okay, shit, now what am I going to do?
Wow, interesting.
So what I did is I just had him...
You gave him an overbite.
I had him bite the throat still and kind of chew around there, but it just scared the guy and made him push him away. So he got out of the bear hug that way. But that's just one example. I mean, it happens quite a bit that somebody will point out something that I can easily change.
Love it. You know, with these books, specifically Row Agenda, you know, we had the privilege of reading Second Ship, which is kind of an interesting jumpstart because after reading a little bit more detail and seeing sort of the chronological order, which was one of your blog posts that was available on Amazon, it kind of showed like that it kind of fit right in the middle of that series. Sort of like A New Hope for Star Wars Episode 4. But, I mean, the concept of two warring alien factions, I mean, when you write about something like that, would you say that you believe in truth, in the real world out there, that aliens do exist? If not, I mean, would you say that it's just simply government experiments that are happening with some technology that's just so advanced that we don't know anything about it, it's not made public? Or alternatively, if you do think they exist, and personally I do, do you think that they've been to Earth? Do you think that they're still here when they visited? Did they decide to buy some timeshare property and just kind of kick their legs back and just have a good old time sipping Mai Tais? Like, what's going on with the alien life?
Getting to the first part of that, you know, I just think the odds are not good that we're the only intelligent life in the galaxy or even, you know, in the universe for sure, but when you think of all the trillions, quadrillions, quintillions of planets out there, the odds that intelligent life developed are obviously non-zero, okay, because here we are.
Right, exactly. That's true.
So those dice get rolled a lot of times when you got quintillions of planets. So I would say it would be mind-boggling to me if other intelligent life didn't exist, and that the odds are we're far from the most advanced.
Shaf, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. You know, a lot of TV shows...
Elliot, I didn't get to the aliens being here, though. I haven't personally met any that I know of, but that said, there's plenty of strange things that are occurring and that have occurred on Earth, which have made other people that witnessed it, that are not all just kooks, believe that they have visited here. And as for me, you know, when I'm thinking about it from a sci-fi perspective, You know, I'm really thinking about what would cause an alien species to be interested enough to come to a planet like this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a variety of reasons that lots of science fiction guys have written about. But one is we're trying to attract their attention, or at least we're doing things that could attract their attention. Number one, starting over a century ago when we started broadcasting radio and then television, and then we got into testing nuclear weapons, and there's lots of things that could draw attention, good or bad, that are being created by humans.
That's right, like reality TV shows.
Now, Rick, I got to ask you, you've got a wonderful talent for explaining science and making it approachable or even understandable for people. Does that come naturally for you? Do you have a lot of rewrites or beta readers that kind of guide you along that path?
The dreaming stuff up comes naturally for me, but I have to, you know, when I first started out, I didn't really, I used a structure based on what I liked to read. I tried to structure my stuff similar to that. But over time, I got introduced to various resources and actually went to some seminars and stuff on structuring your story and how to put in the skeleton that you build that frame on so that readers have a pacing that they're used to, that they expect. So part of it comes naturally and part of it comes a little bit from my background. But a lot of it is just, you know, sitting down and figuring out the dominoes that have to fall to get you to the end of your story.
Now, when you write, do you write using a voice, or is there some people have a practice of writing to someone in particular, maybe a familiar or a friend, and they write to that person thinking, I want this person to read it, and that way it gives them kind of a center to their writing, a voice. How do you approach that? Do you have anyone that you write to, or do you have that kind of style?
Actually, I don't really think about the voice. What I think about is I want to know that character, their personality, their background, what made them this way.
Interesting.
I want just a shell of a character like that, and then I want to cast them. Like I said,
I can move out.
If I was casting somebody to play this part in a movie, who would I pick?
Nice.
And what movie
that's cool.
He or she participate in that they had a character that I like?
That's
I
cool.
Mean, if you think about Lethal Weapon and Mel Gibson and Danny Glover's characters in that.
Right.
I mean, they pop out at you.
Exactly.
You know, anything Bruce Willis is in, he kind of has that same personality.
Right. So what's your process for creating personalities or multidimensional characters?
Well, first I'll talk about personality. Personality to me, what I like to do is I like to change it up. You don't want everybody acting and talking exactly the same way. So the first way I do that is I figure out kind of what the general outline of what kind of a character I want. You know, is he really serious scientist type, or is he a fun-loving, et cetera, et cetera. And then I give him, I like to go through the Myers-Briggs personality test.
Legit.
That's really cool.
And then I figure out, because if I answer those questions as if I am the character that I'm thinking of, by the end of that, it gives me all the traits that are associated with that personality type, the common idioms and the idiosyncrasies that they have. And so that gives me the beginnings of the skeleton. And then to that, all I do is I have to add in a backstory of where is their life right now, some things about what was their family like, you know, how do they react to certain circumstances. And it just takes some time. The characters kind of grow on me. And by the time I've got the characters where I know them, they have their voice.
I like it. That's cool.
Now, you were talking about casting your characters. So, for instance, Jack is probably one of the most prominent characters in the series. What would you say, who did you cast as Jack?
Yeah. Who's Jack?
I actually modeled him a bit after Wolverine, right?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman,
I mean,
he's the man.
He doesn't have claws that pop out, but Jack is a weird. He's got a very unique personality, an extreme risk taker, doesn't like to fail, that kind of thing. But interestingly enough, when I went back, you know, at first I wrote the middle part of the series, the second ship, Immune and Wormhole. And then I went back and wrote the prequel series because Jack became such an interesting character to so many people.
Right.
And actually, I tied it in sci-fi-wise by at the start of that prequel series, which is called Once Dead, we learn that Jack died in a knife fight in a Calcutta alley. He died on a surgery table afterward.
Oh, deep.
And as he's having this near-death experience, this alternate dimensional being, and like makes a deal with him. You know, I'll send you back if I can come along for the ride, kind of thing.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
So after this point, he makes the deal, and so it kind of jumpstarts his heart again. But after that, he's got significant problems. So I went through all of that to create this character that, you're right, he becomes the central driving force of the overall story for these first three novels. And then by the end of those, you learn who this alien being is and how he's tied in to what is going to be the second shift in the rest of the Roe Agenda series.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, in terms of stories, I've definitely tried to dabble myself in that world and try to write. I wouldn't say like my problem is dedication and focus. And even with a short story I recently wrote about a World of Warcraft character of mine.
Yeah, that was fun.
Some fan fiction. Yeah, yeah. Quinn challenged me and I rose to the task. But even trying to get 2,000 words, I found myself struggling a little bit. But I did find that goal was an obtainable one. But then I think about, I mean, you've got... That's 9 books just in that Roe Agenda series, plus I'm sure there's more things going on.
Well, like, what's the average length of your novels, Rick? Like, average? How many words?
My longest novel was Immune, which is around 140,000 words.
Holy balls, that's a lot.
Typically, though, I like to write between the 90 and 110,000 word range. A couple of my books have been in the high 80,000 range. It depends on the pacing, and it depends on how much you're trying to cram into the story. For me, it's determined by, I really think the important part that it really helps in the writing process is to understand the basic structure of a three-act novel. And, you know, there's a great little book that summarizes that. It's by a gal named KMK, like in Kilo, M as in Mike, K.M. Weiland, W-E-I-L-A-N-D. Anyway, she writes a series of how to write books, but essentially in this very thin book, she lays out how to structure your novel. And it's called Structuring Your Novel, strangely enough.
how appropriate.
but that really helps, because then you get all the major plot points outlined there. And then your story is you just got to, you know, fill in the gaps to get yourself to those points.
Well, how do you stay so dedicated, though? I mean, when you've got such full-length novels and you've got a huge story to tell, and, I mean, it seems like there's probably, in terms of what you could share for your story about the Roe Agenda, there's so many avenues to explore. How do you just stay with it versus going and stopping that idea and moving to something else?
Yes, how do you?
I had a terrible problem when I first started writing. And only my wife snapped me out of it. When I started out, first of all, when you start out, you're not very good, okay? You just get better with practice. I mean, as you go, you get better. It just happens. So I was writing, and so I'd write a few chapters, and then I would stop. And then when I got ready to start up again, I would say, you know, I'm really not happy yet with those first few chapters. I'm going to go back through them, clean them up a little bit, and then I'll write more. And so I do that. And then I got in that habit, and it just ground me to a halt. So finally, one day, my wife, Carol, said, just finish the damn book. You can edit it later. And that was the best advice I ever got, because by the time you get to the end of the book, you understand the story, you know your characters better. You've got a first draft out there. That's all it is. So it's an ugly baby. But you've got the damn thing out there. And then the cleanup part turns up to be much, much easier, because if the dialogue is weak in some area, okay, you clean it up. If you don't like a chapter, every once in a while I'll have some chapter where not much happens. A character is traveling from L.A. to New York. Well, that's not a really exciting chapter. So I either add something exciting to that chapter or I cut it.
Right, exactly.
Now, so with that, like, you've got multiple books. What if you wrote something in, say, book one, and now you're like, you feel stuck because you wrote something about them. Now it's part of sort of canon for the series. Do you find yourself in that dilemma when you're writing these series books?
Specifically with Reese, I assume you're talking about a character that you wrote one way in book one, and now you wish you had them, you had made them a little different?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like you feel locked in now for something.
Well, actually, you're not locked in, and that goes back to your multidimensional character thing. You know, the reason I say you're not locked in, all you've got to do is, let's say you've got a character that you wrote as straight-laced and you wished, you know, they had some other serious problems, not so, you know, just a straight-laced good guy. Well, all you got to do is put them through a little hell where it's a life-changing event, and your characters will change one way or the other. You know, either they might have been a drunk earlier on. Well, you put them through something that scares them straight. You know, they end up having to get themselves in rehab and changing their lives, or your good guy character from high school goes off to war and endures things on the battlefield that change them. So it's always possible to change a character in a subsequent book and have them become the person you want them to be, even if it's bad.
Wow.
So
that's actually really insightful.
A good example is in my second shift, the three teens were really overly innocent. You know, they had lives where it seemed almost unrealistically Leave It to Beaverish.
Yeah.
And then they stumble on a lost spaceship, okay, one of the two that shot each other down that the government didn't find. And they get augmented, you know, the AI on the ship changes them and enhances them, which they think, oh, that's great, this is a really cool thing. And then they start having problems, and eventually the story sweeps them into a larger battle between the agenda of the ship the government has, the row ship, and the agenda of the second ship. Although no crew members survived, those agendas survived. And those competing agendas end up destroying the comfortable lives that these kids had, making them lose their family, et cetera. So during that process, these kids actually become different people than what they started out as. And that is, you know, when most people are talking about multidimensional characters, they don't know what they're talking about. For example, they'll say it's bad to have a flat character. Well, there's tons of interesting flat characters. Adrian Monk of the Monk series, you know, he's a detective that almost can't go out of the house because he's got OCD so bad. But at the end of every show, he's completely unchanged. I mean, there's no events, no world events have changed him.
Yeah, there's
James
no growth.
James Bond, Sherlock Holmes, you know, they're the exact same character, Iron Man. He might go through a bunch of crap in the story, but he's the same snarky, arrogant guy he was at the start of the story, okay? So that would be called in my mind, that's a flat character, a character that is unchanged by the story. Character, which is important to have in a story, I believe. But characters that events change into a different person than they were early in the story, those people are what people would refer to as three-dimensional characters, or characters that have a story arc to them. So Jack Gregory and Janet Price, in my story, are flat characters, intentionally. Jack Gregory is not changed by the events he goes through. I mean, physically scarred, yes, but he's the same character he always was. Whereas those three kids are changed by the story they're going through.
For writers or anyone that wants to write about science and maybe aren't as in-depth or as credentialed as you are, is there any resource for sci-fi writers or would-be writers to collect information regarding physics, chemistry, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, Google and Wikipedia I like a lot, because at least Wikipedia will give you the gist of whatever topic you're thinking about. But I think the best resource is read good sci-fi or watch good sci-fi movies and see, you know, how are they making us suspend disbelief in these things that can go faster than light. You know, there's some commonalities out there of the way sci-fi writers create a world with consistent rules. And that's the most important thing. I mean, even if you think about a fantasy series, in fantasy, the important thing is if you've got some kind of magical system going on, that it has consistent rules and that, you know, there are costs for doing things. Everything just doesn't magically happen. So I think that's the most important thing, is just develop a consistent set of rules, even if it means copying rules somebody else used.
Now, we've got 5 tips that we received from Rick. I'm going to put those on our website so you'll be able to read them. But I think we had a recent event, an anniversary?
Yeah, so this year is the 20th anniversary of the famous Phoenix Lights that happened on March 13th, 1997. And Rick, we just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on the Phoenix Lights. I mean, coming from Roswell, New Mexico, I mean, you're certainly no stranger to sort of that alien pop culture where it's like people flock to these spots to sort of get a glimpse or have an experience that might be extraterrestrial in that regard. So we're kind of just interested, like, what your thoughts are on the Phoenix Lights phenomenon.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't yet in Phoenix, so I didn't get a chance to see them myself, but I have seen videos of them, and I've read various different explanations of it, and I've actually talked to people, you know, because of my background, et cetera, I'd often go to, you know, when I was first trying to sell my books, which is a real laughable story, but I would go to a number of UFO conventions, you know, the annual one that they have in Roswell. They've got one out here in Fountain Hills, and so I've been able to talk to people that come from a variety of backgrounds that don't seem to be kooks, which you get plenty of those too. But, you know, as far as the Phoenix Lights go, I don't think it's been adequately explained. You know, I don't buy that it was a military formation of the aircraft because it just doesn't behave like a military formation of aircraft in my mind.
Right.
So I just think it's an unsolved mystery, and so I just don't know.
Right. The truth is out there,
yeah,
as Fox Mulder would say.
It is intriguing. It is a lot of fun.
Now, you
absolutely.
Were, yeah.
And speaking of, you know, X-Files, I think, I don't know what you guys thought about Fringe, but the series Fringe essentially is X-Files on steroids, and it was, I really liked.
I loved Fringe. Loved Fringe. I loved when they got into the sort of the multiverse concept of it all. It was very interesting to me. And I loved that Leonard Nimoy had a cool cameo as William Bell in that.
Right.
So, you know, speaking of great sci-fi shows, movies, you mentioned as well that sometimes to write good sci-fi, you need to be either reading good sci-fi or watching good sci-fi. So what would you recommend for, like, your favorite sci-fi movies or TV shows right now?
Yeah, movies you liked.
I like The Expanse right now. I like, as far as movies go, I thought Ex Machina was fabulous.
Oh,
yeah.
That was fun.
Just
I liked
perfect
it.
Right on the science. You know, a lot of sci-fi, though, and this is true definitely in The Expanse series, is not present day. You know, it's way in the future, like Star Trek, by the way, which I love, the first two new Star Trek movies. I thought the characters were fabulous, and I thought the job they did in plotting, you know, how James Kirk came in, and then how, you know, the snarkiness of his character and also the way they did the Wrath of Khan, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were really bothered by the fact that they were, like, rebooting this Wrath of Khan, but I thought they did a great job, and casting Benedict Cumberbatch was probably, I think it's a great idea.
I thought
that
it was
guy.
Fantastic, you know, because I was a big fan of the original Wrath of Khan with Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, yeah.
but anyway, I really did enjoy it.
Awesome. Yeah, I have to agree. Ex Machina, you mentioned, was a fantastic movie. The aspect of the Turing test, seeing that kind of transpire. And I don't really feel like maybe in the next 20, 30 years, we'll be like experiencing that to some degree, where we have to be concerned about technology sort of surpassing us in that regard.
I think almost definitely within 20 years, we're going to face these issues. A lot of people are worried about them right now. You know, everybody from Stephen Hawking to Elon Musk. The big thinkers are thinking about this because, you know, for one thing, we've done, I remember in the 80s, it was so exciting because it seemed like we were on the verge of getting AI figured out. And then in the 90s, that went bust and everybody was like, oh, it's never going to happen. And then they split up so that everybody started working on little different technologies that were pieces of AI, and things like speech recognition, cars being able to drive themselves. All these things are very difficult to do, but they're all kind of coming together on their own. You know, I just think there's going to be a tipping point where general learning becomes possible, and that's going to be a big deal.
Now, for our listeners, you can look up Richard Phillips on Amazon.com, follow his Row Agenda series. Also, you'll find his website, secondship.com. Rick, you have some projects maybe you got going on with Row Agenda and maybe other projects you're working on. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the ninth book, which is the last book in my Row Agenda series, is going to be released on August the 8th. And I think for Kindle Prime users, some of them will get that a month early. Amazon has a new Kindle Prime First promotion going on, so I think that should be available even a month earlier than that. So that one completes the Row Agenda Sci-Fi series, and right now I'm working on a new project, which is a series, epic fantasy series called The Endarion Prophecy.
Endarion, how do you spell that?
That's E-N-D-A-R-I-A-N.
Nice.
That's the name of the series, and the first book is called Mark of Fire, the second one's called Prophecy's Daughter, and the third book is called Curse of the Chosen. So I'm working on the third book right now. I've already gone through the edits on the first and second book.
You're a machine.
My publisher is just finishing the cover design on the first one right now. So those should come out. I'm hoping they come out bang, 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 like November, December, January of this year, and into the start of next year.
That's incredible. By the way, your covers are beautiful. They have a really like awesome presentation as far as sci-fi. Yeah, they're vivid. The colors are so bright. Like, even if I didn't know anything about your books or about the plot,
covers,
it would make me want to pick it up off the shelf.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure.
Well, thank you, guys.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for joining us this morning.
Appreciate it.
Of course, everyone listening, please get, if you get a chance, check out the Row Agenda. Check out what's coming up on the pike for Richard Phillips and all of the other projects he's got. Thank you again for joining us, Rick, and of course, everyone, have an awesome, awesome rest of your
Enjoy
Saturday.
Enjoy it.
Have fun, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
So that was Rick Phillips. That was awesome.
That was really, really cool to have him on the show.
He's a cool dude.
Yeah. I mean, so many interesting things to say and talk about. The amount of projects he's got, I mean, that's baffling. I think he's like a artificial intelligence machine himself. Where do you find the time for something like that? The amount of books he's got under his belt. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And then he said he went on vacation and then came back ready to work. So now he's just got the whole weekend to bang it out.
Maybe that's the trick. You gotta take the time for you. Recharge.
Yeah.
Reset. Absolutely.
And then he's got that. So he's wrapping up the Row Agenda.
Yeah.
And then he's going to be going on his new Endarion.
Endarion Prophecy. By the way, it's got to be so cool to have like a 9-book series and to be sort of at the culmination of reaching the pinnacle of that, to close the door on a project of his that he's been working on for a decade or more. Like that's gotta be tough to say goodbye to that. I would wonder if like maybe down the road he'll come back to it.
And it probably also feels good.
Yeah.
To have seen that and grow it. Yeah. Now he's departing from sci-fi and going into epic fantasy. So that is fun.
Yeah.
So do you like science fantasy? I mean,
you know, I can't say I've read that much. But
I mean, the genre in general.
I love the fantasy genre. Absolutely. Yeah. I actually think I enjoy it more now than I ever did because of playing WoW.
Yeah.
That it sort of opened that door for me.
Oh,
and now
yeah.
I'm like, I want to explore that world of magic. And
it's fun.
And it's just, yeah, I can't seem to get enough. So.
And then there are fantasy. Now, what good fantasy shows are there? Game of Thrones, obviously.
Shannara Chronicles.
Have you seen the one that came out?
I saw the first episode. Yeah. I like that Manu Bennett's on it because he's a freaking badass. He was on the Arrow show as Deathstroke. And Deathstroke is one of the most badass like Batman villains. And he's pretty awesome. So
I saw the first episode. I didn't like it too much.
Oh, okay. Well, I think part of the problem is it's on MTV.
MTV, that's it.
Like, I would never think to go to MTV for a fantasy show like that. Like, that just seems like a weird platform to be putting a fantasy series on. I don't know.
Yeah. Has it gotten any? I saw the first one and I didn't like it. It just seemed too campy. The sets looked like sets.
Yeah. That low budget element.
Exactly. It seemed like I was watching a soap opera. I just didn't care for it. It didn't translate well for me. Did you watch any more of them? Did it improve?
I haven't seen any more since, but I know that they were greenlit for additional seasons. So I feel like now that they're going to pour a little more money into it, because clearly it was a popular venture for them, that they were able to recoup their costs. So
I would like to see more fantasy movies. Definitely. I think they were trying to reboot Conan.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I think it was laid to rest. Arnold said he wasn't going to do it. Then there were rumors about it's going to happen anyway.
And then there's the Warcraft movie, which kind of, we thought was going to be the start of a huge franchise, but just.
Well, they got greenlit to do a second a second movie because of how well it did in China.
That's true.
In USA, it bombed. But in China, it did so well, so they've got the budget for it.
I find that fascinating that, like, a movie could be so poor here but so incredible there. It just, I think what we absorb too much, like we consume on a regular basis, is the dumb shit, like reality television. You know, it's like, that's what we want more of. Like, no, we don't need any more of that. What we need is like really awesome fantasy movies, and thankfully China can appreciate that. Yeah, that art of that cinema. So,
well, let's ask our listeners what you all would like to hear us interview more book authors, maybe more like agents to do with TV and film.
Yeah. Or screenwriters for maybe something happening. Screenwriters. For film or TV. Maybe
even local performers.
Yeah, actors. Actors are always very interesting and do love their whiskey, so.
Yeah. Well, that was good to go. We are out of time. That's, we're going, right, to wrap it up, and then we're going to be back here Tuesday for our regular podcast.
That's right. Yeah. Tune in this coming Tuesday for the next episode in the Sci-Fi Happy Hour. Yeah. Have a great Saturday.
Take care.